For many years now, Russ and Craig have had many wide-ranging conversations with folks from all over the gaming world. This is one of those conversations.
D6G, The Lost Chapter.
Russ, can you pass the Splenda?
Sure. You should. There's a lot of chemicals in the Splenda stuff, Craig.
I don't care. I like it, and I need five for my big iced coffee.
You know, why don't you just get one of all the different ones? I've never understood
Russ.
Why people don't do that when they go to a place like Dunkin' Donuts. You've got like the red ones and the blue ones and the yellow ones. Why don't you and the white ones?
Mix them all together.
One of each.
This is Chris Weave.
Chris, nice to finally meet you here at Dunkin' Donuts.
I told you all about him from HonorCon.
Craig was raving about you from HonorCon. I can't believe you're up here at Dunkin' Donuts with us. This is fantastic.
I can't believe that you're at my Dunkin' Donuts.
It's very strange. Well, it's all. See, this is the thing. I've been thinking about
Dunkin'
this.
Dunkin' Donuts is an eddy in the space time.
Well, I was
going
to go on. So imagine if you will, because I know, Chris, that you're an expert on all things Navy, and also you're an expert on a lot of sci-fi stuff. So I want to ask you this. I think there would only be one Dunkin' Donuts in the entire United States if we had teleporter technology like in Star Trek. Because if you wanted to go to Dunkin' Donuts, you'd just beam over there to the giant Dunkin' Donuts somewhere in middle America that was like 30 stories wide and tall. We'd all be there sharing our donut. We'd beam back to our houses, right? Or to work. You could have one giant centralized distribution center for Dunkin' Donuts.
That sounds like something that Games Workshop would want to get in on. Doesn't that sound like something from a Games Workshop story?
It does, actually.
It would be the size of the Mall of America.
It would be.
Yes.
Enormous,
everything would be that way.
Decorated.
You'd have a giant McDonald's. You'd have one giant McDonald's, one giant Sears Roebuck, one place you go.
And they'd all be radioactive, but people wouldn't care.
Right.
That's right.
From all the transporting. But, since and by the way, while we're here at Dunk, what's your favorite donut, Chris?
Oh, it sort of depends. I mean, I kind of like this time of year. I kind of like the pumpkin donuts.
Mm-hmm. You guys and your pumpkins.
The pumpkin muffin at Dunk's is really good. You got to try it out.
Yeah, it's really pretty good. I'm also a big fan of just your typical glazed donut. In fact, it's not in Dunkin' Donuts, but here in Charlottesville, where I live, there's something called Spud Nuts.
Oh, what is that?
A spud nut is to a donut as potato bread is to regular bread.
Oh, my.
It's donuts made with potato flour.
Wow.
So you know how that texture of potato bread is different? It's a glazed donut made with potato flour.
Wow, that sounds pretty darn good.
Wow, that sounds
darn
intriguing.
Tasty.
So that's what we figured. We figured if we have a professor of naval warfare, the former professor of naval warfare college with us, we should talk about donuts. Because that's what we should do. But actually, I want to ask you, since we got you here, we figured let's talk about because you have this presentation you've done before at HonorCon and other places, right? Where you talk about the differences or the similarities or what are the similarities between actual real world, sea going navies? I guess there's not really any other kind, but versus sci-fi space navies and where the similarities and differences would be, right?
Now, Russ, before we go there, though, I think it's important for the audience to know, this isn't just some guy that we bumped into at Dunkin' Donuts who's talking about navies in space and on the water.
Well, clearly, anybody who knows about Spud Nuts would be an authority on space navies. I don't think we have to go any farther than
that. That's true. But going out on a limb and assuming that the Spud Nuts connection is not enough for the diehard people in the audience, Chris is a former Naval War College professor and a naval analyst within that realm, and so he knows about navies, and he knows about space navies because he's been on TV shows like on the Discovery Channel talking about alien spaceships.
Right.
Yes.
So, multiple people who pay for this stuff have paid Chris to talk about this stuff. And we're here to pay him in some sort of inferior non-spud nuts sort of confection mind.
I should point out the Discovery Channel people actually didn't really pay me. They gave me they gave me some tiny amount of money for my time when I did the trip down to New York City to talk with them. It was really more about about the fun of doing it. I got to work with Stan Schmidt and Michael Flynn and Paul Levinson and Chuck Gannon on this project. I met David Bartel on this project, who's a great guy, and I hang out with whenever I get a chance to run into him at con. So I really got it. Like the organization I belong to, BU9, the joke internally is we pay our people in fun. Right. So the Discovery Channel really paid us in fun.
Paid in fun. That's awesome.
Okay. Yeah. That's cool, though.
And I'm glad you brought up BU9, too, because they're also the group that works, you guys have bought stuff with David Weber around the realism and science behind the Honorverse. And also, he was in our show. He calls you guys up for advice around what his ships are going to do next. And so clearly you've got a great background for a really interesting conversation about this idea of the differences and similarities between sea navies. And my very first question for you here, Chris, because I find this interesting. I've always asked myself this question whenever people would complain that there's no seatbelts on the Starship Enterprise. They would say, there's no seatbelts on the Enterprise. That's stupid because you always see them falling around the deck. Why aren't there seatbelts? And I always thought to myself, well, they don't, because the Enterprise is based on a seagoing vessel concept. But really, why do we think, almost all of us, think about spaceships, especially capital ships, and we immediately think about their parallels to navies, and we all think about how they'd be similar to navies. Why don't we immediately jump to aircraft and their similarities to airships or large airplanes? Because, in fact, most of our astronauts are aviators, or were aviators in the beginning, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And when we currently launch our limited spacecraft we have today that are real, all those people are in seatbelts and they're flying the space shuttle program is an aircraft. So why do we immediately make this jump, though? But in the far future, it'll be like a navy.
Well, that's a really interesting question. And if you wanted to start with first principles and think about, what the path will look like from here to there, it seems very clear to me that you're going to end up with this specialized group of people drawn from a variety of service backgrounds and civilian backgrounds. And they're going to sort of like they're this interesting little subspecies of aviator, and they'll gradually sort of turn into something that is – sui generis. It's just them. It's, mm-hmm. You're a space guy your entire life. That's where we're headed. In the meantime, though, it was very convenient for people to think in terms of navies, because the attributes of being on a spacecraft and the attributes of being at sea have some similarities. Now, those types of vessels are going to look very different. And one of the arguments I make is that in most cases in science fiction, somebody just took a terrestrial model of a navy, ran it through the science fiction converter, sometimes without even bothering to turn it on,
right.
And, slapped the word "in space" on the end, and hey, I've got myself a navy. There are some similarities there in terms of like how they go about and do their thing, right? Mm-hmm. You go away for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. You're sort of out away from immediate help, immediate support. You may have communication issues where you can't communicate with the home base.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think about what Jim Kirk did on a weekly basis,
right,
and what Horatio Hornblower did in the novels, there's a lot of similarities there. You go over the horizon, you go beyond the limits of the solar system, and you're on your own. So the Navy has developed command structures, procedures, et cetera, that lend themselves to being run through the science fiction converter and done that and processed that way. Air Forces, the longest mission that's ever been done by an Air Force bomber, mm-hmm. Is some of the B-2 missions that we did in Kosovo. It was probably more recent than that. But they were on the order of 36 hours, 42 mm-hmm. hours, something like that. A much different sort of thing than going out for 6 weeks or 6 months, or in some cases, 2 years, 3 years. So it really is kind of a different animal. Now, there's a great scene in one of Steve White's books where the Space Force in this particular book, and I can't remember the name of it. It's killing me, but if you go looking for it, it'll be easy to find. It's like The Disinherited or something like that. the Space Force in that was descended from the Air Force. And at one point, one of the characters is really sort of kind of ticked off because people are starting to Navy terms are creeping in.
Oh, yeah.
Like they're calling it the bridge.
Yeah. You know,
damn it, it's not the bridge. It's the control room.
It's the cockpit.
And so there's this culture clash issue. There's a guy named John Lumpkin who wrote he's written a couple of books. The first one was called Through Struggle of the Stars. And in that book, he's one of the few guys that I've seen who's done something like this. He is looking in part at the cultural issues that occur when they create the Space Force. So there had been like the naval side of the space Navy part, you know, the space side of the Navy. There had been the space side of the Air Force, and Congress had come along and said, you know, you guys should really sort of be together and stop wasting, you know, stop having redundant programs, et cetera. So you've got all these Air Force guys and all these Navy guys, and they're having some severe culture clash.
Right.
Which, incidentally, I work with Navy guys, I work with Air Force guys, and they really do have different views about some issues. In fact, I was saying to one of my colleagues just the other day, it's like, you know, I can tell you're an Air Force guy because that's a very Air Force answer.
Yeah, they would also attack problems very different ways in some cases too, right? They would look at things differently, even just trying to solve a similar problem, maybe.
Yeah, there's a very much so. There's a very interesting book by a guy named Carl Bilder, who's unfortunately he passed away before I got a chance to meet him. He was a RAND analyst, and he wrote a book called Masks of War, and it's about the culture of the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. Unfortunately, he didn't include the Marines, and a lot of things about like how they identify themselves, you know, how they sort of view themselves in their role within their service. And it's a fascinating book. And one of the things I've discovered about Carl Bilder is if he wrote a book, it's worth reading. It doesn't matter what the topic is. He worked at RAND for like a godzillion years.
Yeah.
And everything he wrote, as near as I can tell, was brilliant.
Oh, cool. On my list. I'm adding him now. So for a lot of sci-fi authors when they or people who create sci-fi universes, do they identify maybe with some of the I don't want to say goals, but the thinking and mindset of what the Navy does sort of fits into their storytelling, like you were mentioning before, like mission lengths. I hadn't really thought about that before. That's a, you know, clearly mission lengths are much more parallels there in the Navy compared to what, you know, Gene Roddenberry was trying to do with Star Trek. Are there things like that in other universes too, where how the Navy runs itself makes more sense, or just the sci-fi author thinks, yeah, a bridge makes more sense on this giant vessel I'm building than a cockpit would make sense because the size would be too small in my mind, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it really is a case that I refer to this as being a naval metaphor, that it's a way of sort of – it's a shorthand for how to think about the problem. And it's very easy for people to sort of go, well, you know, you live on your ship. You live on your spaceship. You live on your aircraft carrier. It's your home in addition to being your workplace. So it's very easy for people to sort of look at that and go, yeah, these are kind of the same thing. This is the right way to think about this problem. And the other thing I think is that science fiction authors oftentimes I have yet to meet a science fiction author who isn't also interested in history. So you go back and you read some of the historical literature – like Horatio Hornblower, or the straight stick history stuff for Nelson and the great explorers of that area and Columbus, et cetera, et cetera. There was always a Navy involved in there somewhere.
Right.
You know, there was always a ship there somewhere. Airplanes are a relatively recent invention. We've had them for a little over 100 years, whereas we've had ships for literally thousands of years. So there's a rich historical tradition that authors can draw upon. There's a lot of things that they can look at that they understand, and they can see the similarities.
Is that why too? So I get, yeah. So that makes sense, and I think it. And I just, and I'm always asking myself, does it feel right to me that the Navy should, that sci-fi fleets should be Navy based because it's been ingrained in me now in so many sci-fi books? Or is it elsewise? And it sounds like it's a bit of both. Like it just makes sense. I think we accept it because it's it does fit into history. But is that also why? Because aircraft, as you mentioned, are relatively new. And it seems to me that a lot of sci-fi books ignore the concept, or not books, but a lot of sci-fi universes in general ignore the concept of carriers, right? So you get a lot of sci-fi, like if you look at Star Trek, really, there are some ancillary books, and I know Starfleet Battles had a nod to it and stuff, but most core Star Trek canon doesn't, they don't have, the Federation doesn't use carriers. It's all capital ships. Is a lot of that in other sci-fi too, because the overwhelming amount of naval history doesn't have, because aircraft are new, carrier combat is relatively new?
I hadn't actually thought of it from that point of view. That's a very good point. I actually think that in some ways there's too much aircraft carrier analogs in mm-hmm. science fiction. Let me say something specific about Star Trek, and now I'm going to fly my Star Trek geek flag for just a second.
Go for it.
In the sort of straight stick Star Trek universe, big, big, big warp engines are necessary to get any sort of significant FTL speed, significant maneuverability, right? So it's not a universe that lends itself well to fighters.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be a universe that lends itself well to fighters. It should be a universe where it's really about the big ships, because the big ships are the fastest and the most maneuverable ships.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've got some sort of balance between mass and power. So it's not the case that, you know, you could have a bigger ship that's slower.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't surprise me that there aren't fighters in that universe, except for things like Starfleet Battles, where they decided that they were going to put them in whether they made sense or not.
Right.
And I've always liked universes that came up with a set of ground rules and then followed them where they pointed.
Mm-hmm.
If the ground rules point to fighters, that's great. If they don't point to fighters, then that's perfectly fine too.
Mm-hmm.
What I really dislike are situations where they sort of say, well, you know, the ground rules don't point to fighters, but fighters are cool, so we're going to add aircraft carriers.
Right.
There's some other things to keep in mind about aircraft carriers, though, in particular. And that is, an aircraft carrier is all about the flight deck.
Right.
The purpose of the aircraft carrier is to have a big flight deck moving fast through the water, because you need the wind over the deck for the wings to work.
Right.
And that flight deck is a door between the sea and the sky.
Mm-hmm.
That's the right way to think about it. It's this interface device that lets you go from being moving very, very slowly to moving very, very fast in an entirely different medium.
Right.
Well, when you're out in space, you don't have a different medium. You don't need something that looks like a flight deck. You want to launch a TIE fighter, you push it out the back door.
Right.
And it floats away.
Right.
So you don't need that flight deck. On an aircraft carrier, since you need the big flight deck, you want it to be high above the water so it's out of the turbulence near the surface. You want it to move through the water, so you need a big ship with big engines. Now you've got a very big ship.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you've got a very big ship, let's put everything on it.
Right.
So we put a whole bunch of airplanes on it, and we put a hospital and a mail facility and a command and control nodes,
right,
and a dental clinic and all this, right, other stuff. I mean, aircraft carriers are cities.
It's a city at sea, right? Yeah.
A city at sea. It really is. It's amazing the things that you can that are buried in corners of aircraft carriers, because they just got a ton of space.
Right.
Everything's packed in pretty tight, but, you know, if you're going to put it somewhere, you put it on the carrier because it's got the space.
Right.
Well, if you don't need that big flight deck, why put all your eggs in one basket?
Mm.
There might still be some reasons to put your eggs in one basket through efficiencies of, you know, like if there's a particular widget I need to fix an airplane and it's a big widget, but I only need one of them for an entire squadron, okay, maybe it does make sense to have some efficiencies by putting everything on all your eggs in one basket. But now, with the physics of the situation, we put all our eggs in one basket because we have to, and we declare it to be a virtue. We make a virtue out of necessity.
Right.
If it's no longer required, do you build a ship that looks like that?
I see. So that's interesting. So basically we're saying that if you could come up with a tactical reason to have fighters, you wouldn't have one central carrier. You might have smaller ships that deployed fighters discreetly, or are you saying that it's pretty hard to argue in space that there's a tactical value to fighters, that maybe just smaller strike craft that can get around are all you need.
This is one of those situations where it, where your going in assumptions really, really determine your results. So it all depends upon, like, how long you think your ship is going to be out there, how fast it moves, you know, what's your life support penalty, things like that.
How does FTL work, or high-speed drive work, right?
All of that stuff. Yeah. So I don't think that there – I would argue that there isn't a right answer. Just like when I do a talk like this at a science fiction convention, I always make a point of saying that there's no single correct answer, that it's all assumptions dependent, and that you shouldn't come out of the talk not liking something that you liked when you went in.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
Because, like, for instance, I do a talk where I talk about how aircraft carriers in space don't make sense.
Right.
Battlestar Galactica is one of my favorite TV shows.
There you go. And that's an aircraft carrier in space.
It's an aircraft carrier in space.
In fact,
I don't think it is a product of its environment. And that, when I say don't make sense, what I mean is it's not a product of its environment. It's unclear to me as a naval analyst what the inputs into the equation were that when you look at to the right of the equal sign, it says aircraft carrier in space.
Right.
So,
especially the long landing strips on the Galactica, that I never really understood that.
Yeah.
Like, why do they have to come in fast? You're like, just slow down.
It just doesn't seem to make sense to me. And you can maybe make the argument that the long landing is really more about having the launch tubes on the sides of those launch bays and being able to get the entire squadron out at once through those launch tubes.
Right.
But then it sort of begs the question, okay, if that's what you're optimizing for, then why are some of the other decisions made that way? You know, like, why aren't you having launch tubes all throughout the ship? Why centralize that stuff?
Right.
And, you know, you can come up with good reasons why. I mean, you can make arguments about you want to have that stuff isolated so that because you're dealing with a dangerous fuel and you want to be able to, you know, keep it contained and, you know, or other things, you know. And there is style that goes in all this, right? Mm-hmm. There are certain philosophies that different nation states have when it comes to their navies. I mean, you could look at a Russian ship and go, that's a Russian ship.
Right.
Because they have a certain set of biases that they use. I don't mean bias in a bad way at all. I mean, it's just, you know, these are the sorts of things that they think are important, and their ships emphasize those things. And we have a different set of things that we think is important, and our ships look different as a result. So, you know, I look at a bunch of that stuff and I can't quite figure out exactly why they did it the way they did it. There's another model that I think actually may be, shall we say, more a product of its environment. And that's thinking about fighters as torpedo boats.
Mm.
We tried, and by we I mean humans on Earth, we tried to do torpedo boat carriers. The French built a torpedo boat carrier. And some other – the Brits at least talked about it. Jackie Fisher, when he was first Sea Lord, talked about dropping torpedo boats from a ship. The problem is torpedo boats were really susceptible to their environment. They were really short-ranged. You know, weather was a big problem for them. They really only worked in sort of sheltered areas, and they only worked in great numbers, and they only worked for short periods of time in good weather. But, you know, think about all the things I just said that were limitations and think about how many of those limitations apply in space. And the answer is none of them.
Right.
So maybe a torpedo boat carrier in space makes more sense. Mm. One of the things I like about Scott Geyer's Ganellon series is that he essentially did that. His motherships carry something that he calls corvettes. But you and I would kind of recognize them as being sort of uber-sized torpedo boats.
Yeah.
Mm. And I like that as an approach.
And that makes sense because in that universe, you're going to have small craft because either your larger ships need to have these massive engines to get where they're going for whatever reason, and they can't maneuver well, though, in close, or you want to decentralize your attack and be able to project power somehow without having to split that ship up, right? So you can come in. I guess one of the ideas would be you could send a mothership in, it has fast and light drive. It gets into the system, and then it can launch a bunch of these smaller craft that can now travel around the system and project power into different areas, right? Is that sort of the idea?
Yeah, and we see some things like that in gaming, like the Battle Rider concept from Traveler, from the old Traveler RPG, was essentially that. Oh, you know, why carry around the extra mass of your FTL engine when in combat that's just mass that's not used on armor or weapons or whatever?
Right.
So you have a tender that takes them into combat, and then they can go off and do combat, and then you pick them up afterwards.
Yeah, you saw that very simple idea in the Star Wars prequels, right? The Jedi ship would drop the ship, Anakin's little fighter off, and then leave it there to come back and pick it up later.
Yeah, you saw it there. You see something very similar. Yeah, similar in concept in the Renegade Legion universe. Mm-hmm. Can you tell I'm a gamer from the 90s?
Oh, yeah. I love it.
the Renegade Legion universe, you know, there's a wonderful essay in the game Prefect that is worth tracking down a copy of Prefect online or, you know, on eBay or something like that, that sort of explains about how the physics of that universe is set up and the implications of the physics of that universe for the type of ships that you use for different types of missions. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the few examples I've seen where it makes sense to have both battleships and carriers. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that oftentimes happens in science fiction is people will mix ships from different time periods.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Starfire is perhaps the worst at this. You've got all these different types of cruisers and stuff like that, and you got battleships, and you got carriers, and you got this, and you got that, and you got the other thing. When in the real world, none of those things occurred at the same time.
Right.
You know, they you might have had sort of holdovers, but you had, as a general rule, you've got something that's your capital ship, and that might be an aircraft carrier, it might be a battleship, etc. And then everything else is just kind of supporting it.
Right, escorts. And yeah, I was thinking about that too. That's really interesting. And let's talk a little bit about those different, the ship classes you might expect and how they translate from the Navy into space, if you will. So if we're looking at it that way, and we're taking the naval analogy, then you're saying there'd be a centralized main class of vessel, carrier or battleship or something, and then you'd have support vessels. What are the support vessels doing for you in space there?
Well, I mean, let's dial back and sort of look at it history-wise first, okay. Right? So through most of human history, you would have, and I'm talking about sort of like the big main fleet actions, right? I'm talking about the instance where everybody is bringing their top level stuff.
Right.
I'm not talking about like the little guys fighting on a lake somewhere.
Right.
Throughout most of human history, you had a ship that was considered to be the primary combatant. Mm-hmm. And then you had other things, other ships that did other things. So like in the Age of Sail, like at the Battle of Trafalgar, ships of the line fought. There were frigates there too. But frigates were in a supporting role. They were there to tow ships that had been dismasted. Mm-hmm. They were there to relay signals. They were there, you know, before they had been there to do some scouting and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of in the battle, they were in a totally supporting role. Mm-hmm. They didn't really fire because they had smaller guns, and the last thing in the world you want to do is attract the attention of a ship of the line in that situation. Mm-hmm. And the ships of the line didn't bother wasting shots on things like frigates. It was sort of like, why would you do that? Why you save your powder for a real target? That really sort of changed in the 20th century. And the reason why it changed was the torpedo. So torpedoes were the first attempt. Well, maybe not the first attempt. You had mines before that.
Right.
But torpedoes were the first modern attempt to sort of make a small ship capable of being able to kill a big ship.
All right.
So it used to be that if you wanted to kill a big ship, you needed another big ship. But now you've at least got the theory that the small ship is going to go out and kill the big ship.
Mm.
Now, it didn't work out that way. And some people would point to that and say, well, it turns out that the promise of torpedoes was, you know, it didn't really matter because it didn't work out that way.
Mm.
Well, torpedoes revolutionized naval combat. They just didn't revolutionize them in the way that the creators of the torpedo thought, because they didn't get the last move. the navies of the world responded to the threat of the torpedo by inventing entire new classes of ships just to make sure that you held those torpedo launchers at arm's length and you kept them out. Okay. Yeah. So now, instead of having like a ship of the line and these escorts that don't really do anything other than maybe pass some signals back and forth. I mean, they're not really escorts. They're really just sort of auxiliary ships.
Right.
Now you've got these small, fast ships that are really sort of intended to extend the firepower and capability, the fleet out in all directions. So it used to be concentrated in a ship, and now it's spread out over several.
Are they two things? Are they projecting power, but are they also screening your key elements from torpedoes and things like that too?
It started off with primarily screening. Mm-hmm. So you had torpedo boat destroyers whose purpose was to destroy torpedo boats. Mm-hmm. And then in one of the great ironies of the naval world, somebody said, hey, you know, I bet I could mount a torpedo in that torpedo boat destroyer. And then they discovered that that destroyers were actually better at as being torpedo platforms than torpedo boats were.
Right.
So now you've sort of spread everything out, and you've got these flotillas of small ships that are actually – serious combatants, but they also were there to protect the battle line, the gun-carrying ships. And then you get airplanes, and it gets really wonky.
Right.
Because then the same thing starts happening in the air, and now you've got a bunch of escorts eventually you end up with a bunch of escorts, so they're just there to shoot down airplanes.
Right.
And, you know, so torpedoes totally revolutionized naval warfare, even though they didn't make the battleship obsolete like certain people said they were going to.
Yeah.
And then airplanes did the same thing all over again. And you went from having surface combat and then you had submarines in there too.
Right.
So you went from having surface combat to air, surface, and subsurface combat.
Mm-hmm.
And all those things operate on different timescales. They have different things that you have to worry about. They have different responses. I mean, as a general rule, weapons that you shoot at submarines, you don't fire at airplanes, and vice versa. And then – so that in turn leads to all sorts of command and control issues that the U.S. Navy came up with different ways to deal with that. And they now practice something called the Composite Warfare Commander System, where you – assign responsibility to individual warfare commanders in a particular slice of that – in their own particular warfare domain.
Oh, I see.
And the admiral gives them his intent. You know, commander's intent is blah, 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 blah. And then the admiral and his staff just sort of sit back and watch the show. And it's very rare to hear the admiral or his staff say anything because – as long as they like what they're hearing from their various warfare commanders, they just let those guys do their business.
Okay. Well, so to go back to the space analogy, so that's interesting. So there's these three different – I think it's all fantastic though. So there's these three different or more different elements going on. And for that to go all into space then, well, obviously the subsurface warfare doesn't really enter in space because you're all in the same – as you pointed out earlier, you're all in the same medium. But does the analogy of – light, fast craft still work, because you still got to, you can't turn on a dime in space, even though, because of mass issues. So if all your ships are large, wouldn't your opponent who has light, fast ships have an advantage on you if you didn't have a way to deal with that also?
Well, I mean, this is one of those things. First of all, it's very heavily dependent upon your technological assumptions. Like, for instance, if you've got a tactically useful FTL drive, that changes a lot of things. Like, say, for instance, you've got some sort of traveler-type hyperspace jump drive, but you can use it at very small ranges. You've got a degree of precision that allows you to use it for short distances, and the drive works over short distances.
I'll put my geek hat on the Picard maneuver, for example.
In some ways, it's kind of the Picard maneuver. Yeah. So if you've got that sort of capability to jump around. But let's say, for instance, you don't have something like an inertial compensator or structural integrity field or something like that lets you maneuver that ship quickly, spin it around quickly. Well, you know, if you've got a ship that's 1,000 meters long, that's a lever.
Right.
So, and the ship starts spinning, think of how many G's the guy at the end of the ship is taking.
Right. Right.
So a ship that's really long like that, if you don't have any of this magic technology, is going to rotate fairly slowly. So, you know, a small ship jumps in, rotates quickly, gets off its shot, jumps away, jumps back in, rotates quickly, gets off its shot, et cetera, et cetera. You could easily envision a situation where those small ships just sort of like wipe the floor with the big ships.
Right. So, so there's definitely scenarios where there's definitely realistic universes that could be written easily that where carriers and fighters make some sort of contextual sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely the case that you can come up with a set of assumptions that will allow you to do that. Now, different authors handle it different ways. Some authors really kind of believe that you come up with your technology and then you live with the results of that technology. Mm-hmm. That's how David Weber did it in the Honorverse because, as he put it, limits lead to good stories. It's in dealing with the limits of the technology that all the sort of nifty cool stuff can happen. Mm-hmm. There are other people that sort of go, this is the effect I'm striving for, so let me come up with a set of assumptions that produces that effect. Both of those are perfectly valid. Like I said, no right answer. Mm-hmm. They have pitfalls. If you're coming up with a particular set of assumptions because you're trying to get a particular effect out the other end, you need to be smarter than the people that are – if you're doing a game especially, you need to be smarter than the people who are playing your game.
Right.
Yeah. This is one of the things that's occurred in – we've seen variations of it in things like Babylon 5 Wars and some of the and some of the games that sort of came out in that era where, you know, they really wanted to have carriers, so they put carriers in the game and you play the game for like – 20 minutes and you go, there's no way this makes any sense whatsoever. Why on earth did they build this thing?
Right.
You know, why do they have fleets full of this thing when I can, you know, eat it for lunch?
Yeah.
There isn't a game out there that isn't going to have more players play it in the first, you know, in some cases 2 days to 2 months than have ever played it before.
Right. And that's where all that's where all the trouble comes in from playtesting and everything is. And I think a lot of gamers, unless you're a game designer, they don't appreciate that, you know, no matter how smart your game designer is, it's hard to beat, you know, 1,000 geeks banging on an idea, right? They're all really smart guys. They played a lot of war games before. They're trying to game out. They're going to run into all kinds of things you didn't anticipate. And it gets into trouble.
And they come to the problem with an entirely different set of preconceptions.
Right. Right. Right.
So, you know, if you've got one guy and he playtests a game for 20 years, that's not nearly as useful as you might think because it's one guy and he's going to approach the problem in a particular way. Mm-hmm. So the real test when you're designing a game is when you hand the rules and all the components to somebody who's never seen it before.
Right.
And you say, I'm not going to talk to you for at least a week.
Right. See if you can figure it out.
Yeah. Go bang on it for at least a week. And one of the things that I've learned as a guy who I spent 11 years doing professional game design for the Navy in one way, shape, or form, and doing sort of hobby game design on the side. And one of the things that I really learned during that time period is that if somebody tells you, I've got this great game, I've been working on it, et cetera, I'm 90% done, I just have to write the rules down. They think they're 90% done. They're really, 10%. At most, 10 to 15% done.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. So and this is interesting. I'm really finding it fascinating because I like – so I have this desire to put carriers in my space combat games. So and I know I'm with you because I think it comes from Battlestar Galactica, to be honest with you. It's Battlestar, and it's also Star Wars, right? Two visual mediums that I consumed when I was a kid. You know, I'm old enough to have seen them when they first came out, and I'm like, these are so they just inform me that is cool. And what really is interesting about Star Wars is, you know, Lucas said up front, look, I watched World War II fighter footage, and I'm like, that's what I want my fighters to do in Star Wars. So Star Wars clearly takes its design patterns right out of history in terms of, I mean, physically wrong, like they bank in space, but even more so in like fleet composition. I mean, he's got frigates, he's got essentially battleships, star destroyers, and then he's got all kinds of fighters. You know, lots of fighters. In fact, it's the central point of almost all the movies is lots of fighters. So I want it in there, and I think one of the advantages that these licensed games have sometimes is that if they come to the table with a license, like, okay, it's Star Wars license, so it's got to have fighters, I'm probably more forgiving than if it comes in and it doesn't have that and I'm trying to figure out why it's realistic. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense to me. I've often said that the first rule, if you're designing something that is like the game version of something that's in another media, is you need to be true to the source product. So if you're going to do Star Wars, we've seen some actually pretty good Star Wars Starfighter games over the years. There was the old West End game, Star Warriors, that I thought did a pretty good job of capturing the flavor. And then we've seen the I can't think of what it's called. Attack Squadron.
The new X-Wing.
No.
It's X-Wing. Well, there's the
X-Wing.
New,
X-Wing. Yeah, X-Wing. X-Wing. I'm sorry. Flight. Attack Squadron is the Star Trek game that's sort of based on the same idea.
Which is what's great about X-Wing is it's almost exactly what Lucas did, because X-Wing takes the rules from Wings of War, which was a World War II, World War One, and then World War II flight combat rule set. So they basically just said, hey, this could work with Star Wars.
and you know, it feels true to the source material.
Right.
Every now and then I've heard somebody say something like, well, I want to do a Star Wars game, but I want to use vector movement. My response is, are you insane?
Yeah.
Because you're not being true to the source material.
And exactly right. And the same rules mechanics would not work for Babylon 5 at all, because Babylon 5 had, at minimum, the whole idea, one of the coolest scenes in the show where the ship's, you know, vectoring one way and rotating around and shooting in other directions. The fighters did it all the time.
So yeah. I think if you sat down and did the math on how quickly they changed direction,
it probably wouldn't work. But the fact of the matter is, you have to be able to have that mechanic.
It was a nod, guys. Right. Come on.
Yeah.
Right.
No. Please don't get me wrong. I didn't intend that to be critical. Right. I just wanted to sort of bound the statement.
Right.
It was a nod to vector movement. They didn't fully implement vector movement, but I'm giving them. You know, I'm giving them a solid A- for the fact that they even sort of understood that vector movement existed.
There you go.
And I really sort of like how they handled that. In fact, and I also like one of the things, and I meant to say this earlier and I spaced it. One of the things I like about Babylon 5 is that each one of those capital ships comes with a fighter complement. So they didn't have a carrier. Yep.
Right.
What they had was, you know, instead of having 80 fighters on a carrier, every ship in the formation had like 10 fighters.
Yeah, and you know, Star Wars is the same thing. Star Wars doesn't have carriers, and I think that's what your earlier point about why would you have a carrier. I like this idea that they're really, it's one threat option on a ship with many threat options. Right? You got your fighters, you got your various kinds of weaponry, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I in a lot of ways I like the Battlestar Galactica example better than the Star Wars example, because over the years, Star Wars has done so many different things in that universe that I've never been able to sort of with a coherent coherent goal. I mean, this is a universe where they can make robots that are capable of autonomous operation for decades, yet they can't make a decent guided missile.
Right. Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, yeah, Star Wars doesn't have... Star Wars is definitely an example of a universe where, you know, you gave those two examples earlier. It's the example of, I want it to look like this in the end, so I'll just give nods to things to make it work. And oftentimes they don't even give nods to it, right? It's just I want it to work that way. So it's not
After seeing episode 3, my big question is, I want to know what the question was that the answer is flying robots with buckets of lava. What is the problem that solves?
That is awesome. Oh, you know, I never looked at that. I'm never going to look at that scene again now. That's fantastic. See, you have to ask these questions. These are the hard questions you have to answer. That's awesome.
I am an analyst at heart.
So that's awesome. And I guess and to go back to Babylon 5 for a minute, another place where fighters, I guess one of the few times it would make sense is this the idea of a space station, right? So fighters would make sense, like a single I guess, a single spot. So if you have, if you're going to have a giant space station for whatever reason, and I guess you have to take it as a point of faith that you need a giant space station. But if you have to have a giant space station because I guess you have a jump point or something you got to defend that's not easily, you know, whatever. That's where fighters make sense because your base doesn't move, right? So it's almost like an island.
Yeah, it might very well make sense in that situation. You're making some assumptions about how easy it is to target the fighters and how well they can withstand a hit or how well they can avoid getting hit, things along those lines. But, I mean, traditionally, you know, torpedo boats do work in certain situations. Mm-hmm. They work if you're in confined waters. They, you know, torpedo boats and small craft. What Sir Julian Corbett referred to as the flotilla, right? Mm-hmm. You've got all these small ships, and they generally operate in large groups. They don't operate singly. But I mean, if you look at like how the Norwegians plan to fight naval battles up in their area of the world, you know, up in the Baltic and things like that, you've got lots of little islands, lots of inlets that you can hide in, and you can sort of dash out and fire your missiles and then dash back. If you've got an environment that's conducive to torpedo boats, they're really effective because they're really hard to hit, and you can build a metric ton of them and just flood the system. In other parts of the world, they don't work. Yeah. I mean, one of the issues you have with a wet navy is just the oceans are big. It's right. tough to get across an ocean. If you want to go from the west coast of the United States to, say, the South China Sea, you need a lot of fuel to get there.
Yeah.
And fuel means big ship.
Right.
So sometimes it's about the life support and all the other stuff. It's not about the combat capability. It's about all the other things that you need to bring with you to be effective to even get there.
And that goes back to the Star Trek, what we mentioned, which is that in that universe, you need sort of a large ship to get around, right? Because the way warp drive works and everything else.
Yeah. Larger ships are – capability is almost always directly related to size in terms of Starfleet ships.
Right.
Now, you've got – I'm talking about warships warships with an asterisk because anytime you start to talk about the military and Starfleet, you need to sort of put an asterisk there.
Right.
Because it's not – Gene Roddenberry – didn't envision Starfleet as being
a military wing.
It's a military service in the same way that the Coast Guard is.
Right. That's a good analogy. Yeah.
Yeah. You talk to Coasties. I mean, if you talk to a Coast Guard guy and ask, are you part of the military? They will, without hesitation, they will say yes. Mm. And I love Coasties. They do great work. But from somebody who spent all of my time working with the other four services, they look weird. they do buoys, you know, they do safety inspections, right. They do fisheries inspections, and they've got this collection of mission sets that all have to do with the fact that there's water involved. But they're really sort of dramatically different in terms of what they do. And they're like guys who spend their entire career in the Coast Guard doing nothing but buoy stuff.
Right. Well, you see that in Starfleet too, right? Because you see, especially in the early seasons of even Next Generation, right, where all of a sudden there's families on board.
Yeah.
You know, and there's kids running around and Wesley Crusher's on the bridge and all that kind of stuff because it's not first and foremost a warship.
And you really saw that in Enterprise, which I think is a vastly underrated show. But you see that when they started putting the Makos on board, because you may recall there was all these Starfleet guys saying, I can't believe they're putting the military on board.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of people sitting in front of their TV sets going, what?
Right.
I thought you guys were the military.
You all have phasers. What are you talking about?
And right. They clearly didn't think that they were the military.
Right.
They thought that they were the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
They thought they were out there to do exploration and gather data and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So
it's an interesting distinction. That's great. Well, we're running a little long, but I had I so I guess we knew that was
we knew
happen,
was going
though.
To happen from
so
the beginning.
So, Craig, you haven't got a chance to ask any great questions. So you
I can't to tell you how much I'm enjoying just listening to the two of you talk. So, anytime something has popped into my head, you've said it almost immediately, Russ. So, I don't have any questions. I am enthralled by your questions and Chris's responses and where they have led. So you guys just keep going. We'll
somehow we got lava carrying robots in
that's
here.
That's my favorite part. Awesome. Sadly, in a conversation that has been awesome throughout, that is does stand out as the high point. But still,
so
not to detract from the rest.
I just want to ask this before we run out of time, Chris. And I know you can't give your I'm sure what you would normally give, which would probably be a 45-minute answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. And maybe we'll talk about it in the main show or get you on again because there's so many things I want to ask you about this. Tactically, so if you look at like what it might be like to fight in space, you know, you mentioned earlier, you know, there's not different mediums. You're just in this microgravity environment, which is probably you're far apart most of the time because you probably have good detection range. So it probably depends on your universe a little bit, though. And you probably have reasonably long-range weapons. And there's probably not much to hide behind, unless using that one planet or that rare case where you got an asteroid belt or something. So, does that sort of set of things really change, or affect the metaphor of putting the wet Navy in space?
Yeah, I think it does. And I had a little bit of a revelation within the last 6 months when I started paying more attention to air combat stuff. Mm-hmm. And I concluded that for a pretty wide set of assumptions, that it's useful to think in terms of beyond visual range air combat.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, when you look at air combat, there's really sort of two parts of air combat. There's what's known as air combat maneuvering. Mm-hmm. That's dogfighting, right?
Yep.
If you can illustrate what you're doing by holding your hands out like a pilot and sort of right. like moving your hands back and forth, you're generally talking about air combat maneuvering.
Yep.
That's stuff that's all with Mark One Mod Zero eyeballs.
Yeah. I had a professor in college. One of my aerospace professors was a fighter pilot in Vietnam, and he'd always break out the sticks with the fighters on the end. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whenever they break the sticks out, you're talking about dogfighting.
Pretty much. Yeah. That's air combat maneuvering, yep. But there's an entire earlier part of that.
Yep.
That is the beyond visual range stuff. And that has to do with things like how good is your radar versus his radar?
Right.
How fast are you moving? And hence, how much energy are you giving to your weapon when you fire it, which Ooh. Will determine its range?
Right.
You know, whose nose is pointed at who? And that includes things like how far can your radar slew? Because mm-hmm. in older planes, there's an actual radar dish and it physically moves mm-hmm. and it can only move so far. So there's lots of tactics that are based upon the idea of I see him first, I launch, I turn a precise number of degrees mm-hmm. designed to keep him on my radar screen, but at the, what they refer to as the gimbal limit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I should emphasize that even though I've worked as a naval analyst forever and ever, everything I know about beyond visual range air combat I've read from the internet.
Okay.
And so if you do a search for beyond visual range air combat, you'll find a bunch of websites that are for flight simulators.
Yeah.
And it's people talking about how to win at the flight simulator. And that's where I've learned everything about this. Because I specifically sort of stayed away from other sources.
Right.
There's lots of those guys when they're talking about that problem, they talk about they have shorthand that they use to describe situations like the point at which he can't evade from my weapon mm-hmm. because the kinematics of my weapon are good enough based upon the speed at which I launched it. And the performance of the weapon itself. Mm-hmm. And as a result, he can't get away from it without actually being within the engagement envelope. That doesn't mean that you automatically shoot it down, right. but it means you can't outrun it. You can't right. just sort of turn away and let it fall from the sky and then turn back.
Right.
And if you think about it, I would make the argument anyway that combat in space is likely to have some of those attributes, right? You can't hide in the way that that you traditionally hide in naval combat. Mm-hmm. You traditionally hide in naval combat in four ways. You hide behind the curve of the Earth. Mm-hmm. You hide behind what I refer to as the interface barrier, which, you know, if you're an airplane, you hide by being a submarine.
Right.
Because right. most of the sensors that an airplane have, you have to actually stick something into the water to detect something underneath right. the water. So the fact that your sensors aren't cross-domain sensors helps mm-hmm. a lot. You hide through the use of distance and space. Mm-hmm. The ocean is big.
Right.
And even an aircraft carrier, when you're talking about tens of thousands of square miles of possible location, even an aircraft carrier, which is 100,000 tons, is going to be hard to find unless you've got some queuing on it.
Right.
And then you hide through the use of low observable features, which we will.
Stealth, right?
Stealth stuff, right? Yep. So you make it so that when the guy uses radar against you, the radar waves bounce in odd directions and they don't go right. back to where the source is.
That's the Romulan tactic, cloaking device.
Yeah, the cloaking right. device. You use a cloaking device of some sort.
Right.
So, you know, if you think about which one of those apply to space? Well, curve of the Earth and interface barrier don't apply. Mm-hmm. The use of distance in space is sort of an assumption-dependent one. Maybe there's a stealth element thing that you can do there, but maybe not. It's really hard to blend into the background mm-hmm. in such a way that you can't be spotted eventually. Mm-hmm. So I got thinking about this, and I came to the conclusion that I kind of like this beyond visual range idea as a mental model to organize my thoughts about combat in space. And this, a lot of this was that specific idea came to me in the context of thinking about combat in the Honor Harrington universe, mm-hmm. where I think it really applies.
Mm. Right.
So myself and some of the other B9 people are having that discussion now. Yeah. About how do we, you know, do we believe that? How do we handle that, et cetera, et cetera? We want to spend a little bit more time thinking about how tactics work in that universe.
Yeah, I think Ringo kind of used that in his series too, right? Where he had all the mirrors set up where they could just project power, you know, huge amounts of solar energy, pretty much anywhere in the solar system. So pretty much as soon as something showed up, they could just take it out at range, basically any range they needed.
If you think back to your Traveler playing days, yeah. the big issue you ran into in a situation like that is that if the target is moving around,
yeah,
you've got this light speed lag. And the target can decrease the effective energy on the ship by just sort of moving randomly.
Right.
So there's a couple of solutions you can have to that. You can have something that makes your targeting somehow better. Like if you add go to the store and buy the faster than light targeting component.
Right.
maybe they're having a sale.
Yeah. Ringo did it with AI. He had a good AI, and also he had the advantage of, in his universe, of knowing the enemy was always coming through the Stargate located.
That's very helpful.
So that's really helpful if you know where they're coming in.
If there's geography, it helps a lot.
Right, and that's what it is. Yeah, exactly. It's like Thermopylae. You know where they're going. You're stuck there. So.
And sometimes the right answer is you just increase the volume of fire.
Right.
if you do a search on – if you go to Google, do a search for Star Cruiser design notes.
Yeah.
You'll find a little essay by Frank Chadwick that's on the net because 20 years ago – thereabouts. I typed it in on my computer and put it up on the internet. Yeah. There's this little essay by Frank Chadwick that talks about the targeting problem and specifically in the context of Star Cruiser, but he starts off with the history of the targeting problem and about how you can increase volume of fire or precision of fire, and you can defend against it by making the effective volume of fire be lower by armoring. Mm-hmm. So that some of the fire is no longer effective, or you can decrease the enemy's precision of fire by something like stealth, right? So he can't see you, so he can't shoot you.
Yep.
It's a wonderful little essay. I think it does an excellent job of capturing all the parameters of the problem. And if you also go to Google and type in Robert Work, And I'm trying to remember whether it, I think it's one of the Air Sea Battle presentations that he did. Robert Work is a former Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Deputy Undersecretary of the Navy, something like that. He was a fairly senior guy in the Department of the Navy until recently. He did a PowerPoint slide presentation that basically makes the exact same point.
Oh, cool.
I mean, I'm reading through this thing and going, this is Chadwick all over again. He talks about nuclear weapons and some other things too.
Yeah.
But I looked at this and I went, this is Chadwick all over again.
Wow. Well, that's great stuff. Well, so we are running long, but this has been a great conversation, Chris, and I can't wait to have you on the main show and talk to you more about these kinds of things. But I think hopefully folks listening enjoyed what we talked about here, and maybe it'll make you think a little deeper about your favorite sci-fi game or book. And as you said, Chris, it's not that any particular design or concept or anything is wrong. It's just maybe you can appreciate some of the background and history, or maybe where the designer is coming from in some of his theories and assumptions as to why that might work in his game or his book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think it's going to start conversations all over the place.
It should be good fun. Yeah. So, and I can't wait to talk about Firestorm Armada with you in the main show either, and how what it gives nods to and what it kind of happily ignores.
I am really looking forward to that, and I really am thankful that I got the opportunity to come on your show. One of the things that that I've told some other people, in fact, I think I maybe even told it to Craig when we had dinner, is that when I was working at the Center for Naval Analysis, every time I went to sea, I had two notebooks. One of them was where I recorded the data for whatever naval exercise I was there for. And the other one is when I wrote down cool stuff that I thought that people I knew who were interested in science fiction, who wrote science fiction, would want to know about.
Oh, cool.
So I sort of view it as my avocation is talking with science fiction fans and science fiction authors about how real world navies work. My fandom superpowers, I can think about real world navies and science fiction navies at the same time.
Oh, that is so cool. Well, Chris, thanks so much for joining us here on the Lost Chapters in Dunkin' Donuts. And we can't wait to have you on the main show here in about a week.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for taking the time out, Chris. And we look forward to talking to you some more.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for purchasing a D6G Lost Chapter. Supporting the show helps it grow.
All this talk of Army and Navy, we kind of forgot the Marines.
I am Sergeant Major Bogus. I am your senior drill instructor. I am here to turn you slimy civilian cesspool parasites into United States Marine Corps space aviators, invoking bow-wrenching fear into the dark hearts of your enemies. Why are you here?
Sir, to find a direction, sir.
A direction? Are you lost?
Sir, I suffer from a sense of disconnection.
Answer the question.
Sir, yes, I am, sir.
Well, do I look like a roadmap to you?
Sir, no, sir.
I am a roadmap. I will lead and you will follow. I will teach and you will learn. When you leave my academy, you will be weapons, focused, and full of purpose. Hot rod rocket jocks of precision and strength, tear-assing across the cosmos, hunting for heaven. What's your name?
Wang. Paul Wang, officer.
Officer? I'm not an officer. I work for a living. Did I hear a sound out of you, Wang? I did. I did hear a sound. How bad was your Marine Corps battle cry? Let me hear your battle cry. I am not impressed. Sergeant, demonstrate a Marine Corps battle cry for this panty waist. Still pathetic. In space, no one can hear you scream unless it is the battle cry of the United States Marines.